So the year was 1983. The place was East Berlin. The protagonists, about a dozen souls, who decided to gather in a cold church basement. It was winter, December of 1983. This was communism. Churches were not doing very well there, and this church was actually locked, but somebody had a key. And these 12 hardy souls gathered in this cold church basement, and one of them pulled out a piece of chalk, and she wrote on the chalkboard these words: "What will the world be like after the fall of the Berlin Wall 100 years from now?" That was the only time frame in East Berlin in 1983 that they could possibly think within. But they said, by God, it may be as much as 100 years away, but we're going to think about it. We're going to envision our future. 12 courageous souls in a cold church basement. Now, as we all know, the Berlin Wall didn't take 100 years to fall. It took 6 from 1983. It fell in November of 1989. And Mikhail Gorbachev absolutely could not have done it, could not have allowed that magical fall of 1989 to take place, had it not been for these people who tilled the soil, who prepared the ground, and who envisioned the future. And that, I think, needs to be the same kind of task that we set before ourselves. We must act in the same way as those brave souls who saw a world that they desired, however distant. No matter how far off our aspirations may seem, we must describe and advocate and nurture and believe in the world that we want to create. Because who knows? Our dreams may not be quite as far off as they appear. So as Dwayne indicated, I kind of want to talk about two things this morning. I want to talk about something that's in the news right now, in the headlines, this looming crisis with Iran. And afterwards, if you want to have a little Q&A, we can talk a little bit about North Korea, which is certainly a related issue and has obviously been in the news just this past week. But I think it's very important to both talk about the agenda of the moment, the peace issue of the moment, which today I think is most fundamentally Iran and North Korea, but also, like those brave souls in 1983, to talk about our larger, longer-term visions and dreams. So let me state my thesis right up front about Iran. I think stopping this looming war with Iran, maybe I'll put this back up here, must right now become the seminal issue for the peace and progressive communities for three reasons. One, everything I hear from my friends inside the Beltway indicate they really want to do it. They really want to go to war with Iran. They think of themselves as Churchill, and they think of the Iranian leader as Hitler. That's their cartoon character image of the world. Two, the consequences of an attack on Iran will be of almost infinitely worse consequences than our fiasco in Iraq. And three, because President Bush is so weak now politically, I think we may, just may, be able to stop this. I guess what I want to say about this is most fundamentally, we in the peace and progressive communities, we know that the costs of war always exceed the benefits, that the use of force always causes more problems than it solves, and thousands of innocent souls who have nothing to do with the dispute in question always end up paying the steepest price. If we attack Iran as we did Iraq without UN Security Council authorization, that once again flouts the UN Charter and enfeebles the international rule of law, violates the international legal system very directly. And if there's anything, it seems to me, that the peace community stands for, it's that long-term structures of enduring world peace can only be built through the world rule of law, through rules that apply universally to every country, to North Korea, to Iran, and yes, to the United States. We all have to operate by the same rules. Instead of us demanding that they adhere to certain standards that we have no intention of abiding by ourselves. If one country, my friends, repeatedly disregards the law of nations, then the only thing we're left with is the law of the jungle. And in that world, rest assured, we won't be the only predator in the forest. So I think we have to stand up for the world rule of law. Now let me just talk real tangibly. If we were to launch some kind of an attack on Iran, the Iranian hardliners would be immediately vindicated. Just like in our country, there's a political debate within the government of Iran. And many are saying that they're threatened by the United States, that they need to defend themselves against the United States, that they need a deterrent against the United States. And any kind of military strike would immediately cause them to triumph within the internal political struggle inside Iran. So what would that mean? It would mean the Iranian government soon thereafter might discard this pretense that they're only seeking nuclear electricity. They might formally withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as every country has a right to do, every signatory, and as North Korea already has done under Article 10, which says if your supreme interests are threatened, you can withdraw. And an attack on Iran by the United States would seem to threaten Iran's supreme interests. And then, I think, they would proceed directly to constructing a sizable atomic arsenal. So unless we plan to bomb them again every couple of years or so, which is hardly the grand strategy of my dreams, the end result of an attack on Iran, paradoxically, would likely be an Iran with more nuclear weapons and sooner. It would be as counterproductive as anything could be. It would bring us a nuclear Iran, with a sizable nuclear deterrent designed to deter us. Not to mention your gasoline bill at $5 a gallon before any of that occurs. So, I want to talk specifically about the New Yorker, April 17th, 2006, article by Seymour Hersh claiming that the Pentagon is planning not only military strikes on Iran, but nuclear strikes on Iran, using nuclear weapons to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons. Hersh has recently said that the debate within the U.S. government seems to change, and right now the nuclear option seems to be off the table, and I'm very grateful for that. But it may well come back. They really, as far as we can tell, inside the bowels of the Pentagon, they really at least have seriously considered this as an option. And President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have both had numerous opportunities to disavow the nuclear option as a possibility, and every single time they're asked, their answer is, all options are on the table. We refuse to take any option off the table, even the nuclear option. Now, as soon as I heard these reports, the word irony just leapt off the page for me. See, I think this possibility of a nuclear strike on Iran to prevent a nuclear Iran poses no less than three towering ironies that I think could haunt us for generations to come. Irony number one: in order to show the world the dangerous, the illegitimacy, the unacceptability of nuclear weapons, we're going to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons by using nuclear weapons. I mean, that is an irony that's just so blatant, so straightforward, so unsubtle, that I think not a single Muslim individual on the planet would fail to notice it. Irony number two is a bit less obvious. We all know about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, of course. It's 36 years old this year, signed in 1970. And the NPT, most fundamentally, and not many people really recognize this, especially in this country, is a bargain, a grand bargain, between the nuclear haves and the nuclear have-nots, where the nuclear have-not states, 187, I believe, is the number now that have signed the treaty as nuclear, as non-nuclear signatories, pledge that they will never produce or acquire nuclear weapons. And in return, the five nuclear weapon states pledge eventually to get rid of theirs. That's the NPT. It's a bargain. They won't ever get them, and we'll eventually get rid of them. And 36 years on, we're a long, long way from really meeting our end of the bargain. But the NPT, my friends, also contains a number of other smaller mutual promises. And some of them evolved throughout the course of the treaty. One of these is that, hear this very precisely, the non-nuclear states, in return for promising to remain non-nuclear, insisted that the nuclear states promise never to attack them with nuclear weapons. Seems pretty basic and straightforward, right? In fact, Robert McNamara, former Secretary of Defense, and Tom Graham, a friend of mine, a former U.S. Arms Control official, they've observed, quote, "This could be the most reasonable request in the history of international relations." Right? I mean, we promise we won't acquire nuclear weapons, but please promise not to attack us with nuclear weapons. So here's the irony in this, my friends. 3 years ago, the United States defied the United Nations to show Saddam Hussein that he couldn't get away with defying the United Nations. Right? That's what happened 3 years ago, right? Now, with these reports that we might actually use nuclear weapons to prevent Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, it seems that the Bush administration is prepared to breach the non-proliferation treaty to show Mahmoud Ahmadinejad that he can't get away with breaching the nuclear non-proliferation treaty. Yeah. Count that as nuclear irony number two. Now, I want to share with you that in response to these Hirsch revelations, my organization, Physicians for Social Responsibility, has actually conducted a study of the medical consequences of a nuclear first strike on Iran. PSR has a long history of analysis along these lines. We published some groundbreaking research in the New England Journal of Medicine way back in 1961. Doing that kind of assessment. So, and this is done with software that's developed by the Department of Defense. And here's what we concluded. A nuclear attack on two nuclear research facilities, the ones at Isfahan and Natanz, would kill, and forgive me, these are tactical nuclear weapons. These aren't the huge things that we were designed to destroy Moscow, one bomb to destroy Moscow. These are tactical nuclear weapons. Two tactical nuclear strikes, one on Isfahan, one on Natanz, would kill 2.6 million people within 48 hours. That's what these columns in the Pentagon are thinking about. 2.6 million people in 48 hours. And soon thereafter, 10.5 million more would be exposed to catastrophic radio fallout in Iran, radioactive fallout in Iran, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, and in India. And much of that fallout could make vast areas uninhabitable for decades to come. If we actually do roll out a few atom bombs, I mean, I'm focusing on this scenario because it is so unique, it is so sui generis, it is so important that we speak out and say the nuclear prohibition must remain in place. If we actually roll out a few atom bombs in the skies over Iran, the distinction between nuclear and conventional war will forever be lost. The taboo that has prevailed since Hiroshima and Nagasaki will prevail no more. The inhibition that has kept everyone from stepping over the nuclear precipice will disappear in a single flash. Osama bin Laden, in his widely publicized statement last January, said his agents were busily preparing operations right now inside the United States. My friends, could anything do more to motivate new recruits, to prepare new operations, than the use of nuclear weapons on them? By us. Hear me now. Nothing could do more to provoke a nuclear terror attack on the United States than the use of nuclear weapons by the United States. And that's why I'm dwelling so much on this possibility. If anything will ever come back to haunt us, it is that. We're the ones who created these weapons in the past. We're the ones who vaingloriously insist that we, but not others, must be allowed to possess these weapons eternally into the future. And now we are the ones who may feel the wrath of these weapons in the present. We, in the end, may be the authors of our own annihilation. We perhaps are the ones who will be devoured by our own creation. And And in the end, that could be the greatest irony of all. And that is why I think it is so important for us to speak out and say the nuclear option, at a minimum, must be off the table. So I'm not quite done talking about Iran, because I think, again, we in the peace and progressive community, we need to not just talk about what we're against, which I just did pretty vociferously. I talked about what we're against, but I also think we need to talk about what we're for. What do we advocate as an alternative strategy to dissuade Iran from joining the nuclear club? Because I don't want Iran or North Korea to join the nuclear club. And eventually, I don't want there to be any members of the nuclear club. It seems to me, I have a PhD in international affairs, and I started the program just as the Cold War was unraveling. So Gorbachev and Shevardnadze became almost heroes to me, because I think they were great, great visionary men who really moved history. And it seemed to me that the great insight that Gorbachev and Shevardnadze offered during that time in the late 1980s was the idea of mutual security. If you threaten your adversaries, said Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, they'll threaten you right back. But if instead you try to make your neighbors more secure, you in turn make yourself more secure. The basis of peace, they said, is understanding the insecurities and the vulnerabilities and the fears of the other side. And I'm just looking for somebody to look at this Iran crisis from the Iranian point of view. It is my contention that everything George Bush has done has exacerbated, rather than assuaged, the fears of Iranian leaders and the Iranian people. I mean, think about it. He announces his intention to initiate unilateral preemptive wars against states that the United States, in its sole subjective judgment, decides someday might pose a threat to us. That's the preemption doctrine. Iran hears that. Then he declares that three nations uniquely constitute an axis of evil. Remember that? Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan. Except there's only two left. Because then he actually launches a unilateral, illegal, preemptive war against one of those three, which happens to be right next door, and decapitates its regime and sends its leader into a spider hole in the ground. And after that, I wish we had a nice map here I could show you very, very explicitly. After that, Iran finds itself surrounded on all four sides by American military power. Iran is utterly surrounded now by American forces. But what would you do if you were Tehran? Wouldn't you try to act in some kind of a defensive, deterrent manner? It seems to me that to step back from the brink of war, both sides must ratchet down their rhetoric. Ahmadinejad's statements about Israel and the Holocaust are odious and need to be condemned by any right-thinking person. But when we say things like all options are on the table over and over again, it must have exactly the same kind of effect within those councils of government in Iran. And I think that after the bluster subsides, we need to offer some carrots to Tehran rather than just waving big sticks. Like, how about enough with the threats and offering a mutual security agreement with formal non-aggression pledges? Tell them they don't need a nuclear deterrent because we're not going to invade them. We don't have any intention of going in and toppling their regime. How about disavowing any effort to bring down the Iranian government, which we've already done once in 1953. Not many Americans know that history, but believe me, every Iranian schoolchild knows that we've already, in the last half century, gone in and toppled their government. Instead, we have Condoleezza Rice going to Congress and saying, give me $85 million for democracy promotion in Iran, which is basically to subsidize guerrilla forces to overthrow that government. Wouldn't you feel threatened? How about proposing some investments in alternative energy technologies like wind and solar and tidal so that maybe we can wean Iran from nuclear energy as well as from nuclear weapons? And how about, for God's sakes, offering to restore diplomatic relations, direct contact, terminated during a hostage crisis that ended more than a quarter century ago? Does everybody know that? We've had no direct relations with Iran for for over a quarter century. Even though a quarter century ago, it ended in January of 81 when Ronald Reagan took office. 25 years and 6 months later, no relations, no direct communications. I mean, it seems to me if we extend that kind of offer to Iran and stop making Iran feel so vulnerable, they might feel a little bit less inclined to cross the nuclear Rubicon. Now, there's one more thing that I think we need to say about Iran and about the Iran nuclear issue. Let me quote former President Jimmy Carter, who with his usual clarity says, quote, "The nuclear states refuse to initiate or respect any restraints on themselves while raising heresy charges against those who want to join the sect." Right? We talk every day. You read about Iran. You read about North Korea. How horrible that they're seeking a single nuclear warhead. And not a word about our own. Here's Mohammed El-Baradei, head of the IEA, Nobel Peace Laureate. Quote, "We must abandon the unworkable notion that it is morally reprehensible for some countries to pursue nuclear weapons, but morally acceptable for others to rely on them. In bazaars and barracks and boulangeries around the world, angry young men repeatedly ask, why can the United States possess more than 10,000 nuclear warheads and our countries can't seek even one? What's the principle? What's the argument? It is never said, and it cannot last, my friends. Some call this the nuclear double standard, others America's nuclear hypocrisy. Ahmadinejad himself echoing the phrase used by the Indians in 1998 when they conducted their nuclear tests. He calls it nuclear apartheid resentment. So what I'm looking for is for some American president to say to the Iranian president something like this. We don't expect you to endure the nuclear double standard forever until the end of time. Doesn't mean we have to get rid of all of our nuclear weapons tomorrow morning. It just means we need to say that we intend to someday. Let's say the NPT doesn't just impose non-proliferation obligations on you, Iran. It also imposes disarmament obligations on us. I just want to hear President Bush say that. I just want to hear President Bush say, we understand, Iran, that you will not forever forego nuclear weapons if we insist on forever retaining nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons won't protect you, and nuclear weapons don't protect us. We know that eventually we must abolish these abominations, or they must abolish us. I think just something like those five sentences coming from the American president would, in a stroke, transform the nuclear policy debate around the world. It would transform the Iranian crisis. And if not the current American president, then maybe the next American president. We must say that we hold this truth to be self-evident, that eventually we must abolish these abominations before they abolish us. But you know, there's even a larger, longer-term dream. Anybody ever hear of Joseph Rotblat? Thank you. Yes, Nobel Peace Laureate, Manhattan Project physicist, spent the rest of his life trying to undo what he felt was the damage he had wrought. He died just a couple of years ago. I was privileged to meet him a couple times before he died. And I heard him say these words from a podium. Quote, "My short-term ambition," said Joseph Rotblat, "is to abolish nuclear weapons. My long-term ambition is to abolish war itself." That's what I think we, the progressive peace patriots, we need to talk about that. We need to do more than just protest this war and that war and the next war and let the guys in Washington set the agenda. That's the title that I took for this talk. I think some of you saw it. Solving the Iran crisis without war and envisioning the road to abolishing war. Because we have to have a dream. A dream about the ultimate destiny of humankind. But I say again, we must talk about more than just preventing this war and preventing that war. We must say that it is within the power of the human imagination to envision abolishing war itself. That's what a peace movement worthy of its name has to be about. We must offer a vision of enduring world peace. We must insist that our goal, however distant, is a politically unified human community, a reinvented United Nations with the power and authority and legitimacy to bring an end to bring an end to the system now, which is settling human conflict always through force of arms. We must seek a world that replaces the law of force with the force of law. You heard me say that at the outset about Iran, that the worst thing about the attack on Iraq and the worst thing about an attack on Iran is that it enfeebles the world rule of law. It violates the UN Charter and shows that some are above the law. And the only hope for enduring world peace is a rule of law that applies to everyone, and everyone includes us. I think, my friends, that we have to believe that 200 sovereign nation states, each with their own armies and navies and air forces, engaged in a perpetual balance of power, always having arms races with the latest in military technology, we need to be willing to say that that's not the end of history. That maybe 50 years from now, or 100 years from now, or 500 years from now, that perhaps the world can be organized in some other, better way. This is the kind of larger vision that I'm just urging the peace community to try to adopt, rather than just get out of Iran. Get out of Iraq, stay out of Iran. I'm for getting out of Iraq, I'm for staying out of Iran, but I'm for talking about our ultimate ambitions as well. My friends, we must declare that thou shalt not kill cannot really mean that you cannot kill a single citizen of your own country, but you can kill hundreds of citizens of another country, and they call you not a murderer, but a war hero. If we really are a peace movement, then we really have to say that thou shalt not kill means thou shalt not kill. That's what we have to be about. We must insist that someday there can be a next step forward in the socio-political evolution of the human species. I try never to give a speech like this without giving you all some specific things you can do if you want to get involved in this kind of stuff at all. So if you have a pencil and paper, just whip it out. I have a couple of websites that I will just give you, and you're welcome to hit me up afterwards if you can't write this down. Some organizations that are right now both trying to stop the next war before it starts and trying to articulate this larger, longer-term vision for the world. One is the one that I work for, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I'm here in the Los Angeles office, and it's very easy. PSRLA.org. PSRLA.org. It'll tell you what Physicians for Social Responsibility is doing. We won the Nobel Peace Prize ourselves for our anti-nuclear work, and there's a bunch of wonderful links there. That's a good place to start. Another one is called UnitedForPeace.org. Very easy, UnitedForPeace.org. That's the largest anti-war coalition in the country. Another one quickly is Progressive Democrats of America, a group that I'm helped to found that's really trying to push the Democratic Party specifically to talk about some of the kind of things I'm talking about this morning. That's pdamerica.org. Again, hit me up afterwards if you're not getting all these down. On the long-term dream, on the long-term idea of abolishing war itself. And here's two websites. One is called the World Democracy Movement, WDMUSA.org, WDMUSA.org. And the other is DWFED.org. They're called the Democratic World Federalists, who really envision one world. They're really carrying the torch of one world. In fact, it turns out that I myself have a piece that's on the weekend feature of Robert Scheer's blog/progressive commentary site called Truthdig, truthdig.com. So if you go to truthdig.com, there's a nice piece by me right up there this weekend with some fun nuclear graphics. And finally, my own little personal website is dailyplanet.org, D-A-L-E-Y, dailyplanet.org, where you can see some of my pontifications about all these things. My friends, we have to believe that the great story of the 21st century, with this I will close, will be seeing our national citizenship absorbed by a global citizenship. That our allegiance to the countries where we happen to have been born will be transcended by our allegiance to humanity. That our national patriotism will expand ever outward into a planetary patriotism. I think that is the most fundamental ethic that we can adopt. We must maintain that national vital interests must ultimately yield to transnational vital interests, the common human interest, the global public good. I want to cultivate the first glimmerings of what the great Princeton political scientist Robert C. Tucker calls an ethic of specieshood. Isn't that a lovely term? We must believe in the fundamental truth uttered by Baha'u'llah. You know Baha'u'llah, the founder of the Baha'i faith? I'm speaking next weekend at the LA Baha'i Center, who said 150 years ago, the earth is but one country, and humankind its citizens. That's a noble ideal that I think we need to adhere to. We must be the vanguard of what Voltaire called the party of humanity. My friends, we today, each one of us, we need to be like those dozen souls. Remember, in East Berlin, in 1983, in that cold church basement, we need today to be the ones who write on a blackboard, what will the world be like if only we have the courage to speak our hopes, to dream our dreams, and to believe in a human destiny of infinite possibility. Thanks very much for welcoming me to the community.